So, topic for this evening, for the last lecture of the season, is the history of the matrilineal principle. We know that, according to Rabbinic Judaism, if a child is born to a Jewish mother, that child is Jewish. And if a child is born to a non-Jewish mother, but even if it's a Jewish father, child is not Jewish. And that might seem like one halachic principle, but it's actually two parts of a broader package. Basically, the anti-patrilineal and the pro-matrilineal. Where does this come from? That's what we have to examine tonight. And I'm only going to get into the issue at the very, very tail end of the talk on how this might have modern-day ramifications and what the controversies were in the 20th, 21st century. But we're going to speak about it from the perspective of the biblical period and the early rabbinic period. Well, these rules about not recognizing the Jewish status of someone born to a Gentile mother, Jewish father, and recognizing the Jewish status of a child born to a Jewish mother, non-Jewish father, they seem to not be known to anyone prior to the second century of the Common Era. Let me say that again. Prior to the second century of the Common Era, not the pre-Common Era. So very, very late in the game, in the development of the halakha, do we know these very key principles to Jewish status. That probably will come as a bit of a shock, because you would imagine things of that great importance would go back to the earliest stages in the development of Judaism, if not the earliest stage. It should be explicit in the Bible, in the Torah, but it certainly isn't. And it's not even articulated in the later writings, not until the Mishnah. And we're going to have to examine, well, before the Mishnah came along, what were the rules? And why did these rules change? Or did they change? Maybe just our perception changed. So, in the Bible, Israelite heroes married foreign women. Give me an example. Solomon, okay. Although in reference to Solomon, let's not refer to him as a hero, because he wasn't heroic in that regard. He built the temple, but he was chastised for having many wives. Who else? Shimshon, yes, and we're going to have to address the particular case of Shimshon because his parents attacked him for it. But give me other examples.
Moshe.
What kind of a woman did Moshe marry?
Cushite.
What else? So, Midianite and Cushite woman. Who else?
Yosef
married Bat Potiphera Kohen On. So let's put Boaz aside because there's too much discussion to be had about Ruth. Avraham married Hagar, who was an Egyptian. Who else? Yehuda married Bat Ishkna'ani Ushmoshua. No, Yaakov's wives were of the family. Well, they, or at least two of them were the family. Okay. All right. But suffice it to say that Judah, Moses, Joseph, David, and many others married foreign women. Okay. Is there a ban on marriage to a foreign woman? Well, Exodus chapter 34 says, V'lakachtami benotav levanacha, v'zanu benotav acharei Eloheihen, v'hiznut banacha acharei Eloheihen. We are instructed not to contract a peace treaty, pentichrod britli osheva aretz. Don't make a treaty with the Canaanite nations, the nations whom you are supposed to dispossess when you enter the land, lest, what happen, you take their daughters for your sons, and their daughters cause you to stray after their gods, and cause your sons to stray after their gods. We also have in Deuteronomy chapter 7, Lo titchaten bam, don't marry them, bitcha lo titen libno, don't give your daughter to their son, ubitolo tikach livnacha, and don't take their daughter for your son. So, whether it's a male child or a female child from the Israelite camp, don't give it over to the other team in matrimony. Now,
the reasoning is that
it says
that you're going to do Avodah Zarah.
Okay. So, if the issue has to do with Avodah Zarah, I ask you a simple question. Is Avodah Zarah a problem only with the Canaanites? Or is it a problem with the Mongolians and the Koreans too?
Anybody.
It's a problem with anybody.
Right.
So, Okay. Yeah, but there were plenty of nations who are non-Canaanite nations who are familiar to the biblical narrator that you would not draw a distinction, you would not make a chiluk between the Canaanim on the one hand and everybody else on the other. So there is reason to suggest that the logic behind the law would apply to other nations, but the plain reading of the text is that it only applies to the Canaanite nations. If we go anecdotally to the earlier books of the Bible, to Bereshit, what do we find about the repugnant character of certain matrimonial prospects? That in the eyes of our matriarchs and patriarchs, they didn't want their children marrying certain groups, but which groups? So let's find out. Let's find out. Bereshit 24:3, Vashpiacha b'Hashem Elokei Hashemayim. Avraham is commanding his servant, don't take a Canaanite girl for my son. So go elsewhere. Find the girl in Haran or wherever, somewhere beyond the border. You're right. It would confuse things if we were one with them. All right, but let's go to the
nations. Yeah. We don't have that problem.
You don't have the nationalist conflict with them. You're right.
But maybe a Kanani could be the archetypical goy without having to be specifically a Kanani.
But that usually isn't the case. Actually, I don't think that's ever the case. Other than in rabbinic literature, the expression Eved Kanani.
What about the theory that we weren't obligated to mitzvahs until after...
Okay, so that's going to be part of the rabbinic answer to justify certain earlier behaviors, that there's pre-Matan Torah and post-Matan Torah. When we get to the Midrashic explanations for the earlier biblical behavior, we'll get to that. Okay.
They had idols in Rachel and Leah's house. Laman had idols. She stole the idol.
Okay, but they were mishpacha. They might have been bad mishpacha, but they were mishpacha.
Are you assuming these are all... converted to Judaism when the marriage takes place?
Okay, so last week we said that conversion to Judaism doesn't exist before the Maccabees. It's the concept doesn't exist. So we're going to have to address the issue in the rabbinic writings about how these earlier biblical heroes who married foreign women must have converted their wives, because the later rabbinic writings have no choice but to say that, even though it's ahistorical. Okay, so let's now go to other examples in Bereshit. Genesis 27, Vatomer Rivka Yitzchak, Katzti b'chayim et nebenot chet. So Rivka says to Isaac, my life is repugnant if my son Jacob were to marry one of the Hittite women. So again, from the broader camp of the seven Canaanite nations, we don't like them, don't marry them. Is there ever an example of someone marrying a non-Canaanite heathen and arousing the ire of a family member? And the answer is yes, in the case of Shimshon. Shimshon HaGibor, Samson, the great hero of our people, strong man. So Shoftim chapter 14, Vayomer lo avi v'imo, ha'ein bivnot achecha uvechol ami isha. Ki ata holech lekachat isha miplishtim ha'arelim. Vayomer Shimshon el aviv, ota kachli ki hi yashra be'enai. So this pasuk happens again and again in the 21st century, when you have a Jewish boy who has a non-Jewish girlfriend, and he wants that girlfriend to be converted, so he goes to daddy and says, go to the shul rabbi so that you can convert my girlfriend. And what does the mother and father say? No, new sonny boy, there was no Jewish girl you found attractive, you couldn't find the nice Jewish girl to take home, we have to convert the shiksa. So it happens all the time. Well, with Shimshon, the same thing. The parents said to him, come on, you couldn't find the Jewish girl from our people that you have to marry this Philistine girl? So, yes, in the Bereshit period, the Canaanites were bad, and in the Shoftim period, the Philistines are bad. But as for other national groups, they might not be so bad. After all, David marries foreign women, so does Solomon and the like. All right, not every intermarriage was bad.
What about the Maisel Pinchas? Didn't he try to show up?
That's because it was a licentious act. It wasn't because it was a foreign woman necessarily, but just because the whole thing was repugnant and it was a disgrace to the chastity of Israel. Okay, so from all this material, we can see that in the ancient world, all marriages, even objectionable ones, were valid, in that it was impossible to have an invalid marriage. It was a non-sacramental matter. We think today in terms of kiddushin, holiness, in the church it's a sacrament, in Judaism it's a kiddushin. But in the ancient world it was non-sacramental. It was simply a man takes a woman into his home, and by simply being taken into the home, she now adopts his nationality, his religion, his everything, because she doesn't have independent personhood. This is a very patriarchal time, and a woman becomes an adjunct to her husband.
That's the concept of the Misuman.
Yes, but in rabbinic Judaism, it's never that extreme. The woman does maintain a certain individuality, not with respect to any sexual matters, but at least on business issues, she can negotiate her own relationship with the husband. She can sue for divorce and get it if the authorities feel it's warranted.
The very religious identification is matriarchal. It's Jewish because of her.
We're going to examine when that became true. Wasn't always true. So now there is a verse that we just quoted before, Devarim 7:3, which talks about the foreign wife steering children towards idolatry, and it shows more than anything else that the religious cult, was the domain of the man, and we're concerned that a foreign woman will, if brought into the Israelite home, corrupt things and veer it towards pagan worship. But what's interesting, that the Israelite women being turned astray by a foreign husband is not mentioned. Why not? Because nobody would notice. She was a lost cause anyway. The man is in control of the situation. The religion follows the man. The location presumably follows the man, his nationality. Therefore, we're worried about corruption being caused by a woman being brought into Israel. We're not worried about the corruption happening to a Jewish woman who was taken to a heathen land, because she's finished.
Wow.
It's over.
Yeah.
All right? There's nothing to discuss.
Did she leave her parents' home and not go back?
Presumably, yeah. Whether it was coerced or not, who knows? Every case was different. But that's why the Bible doesn't bother to mention it, because it wouldn't come up much. Okay, now there is very limited data about an Israelite woman being married to a heathen man. Very, very little data about that. The matrilineal principle was only applied in biblical times when the marriage was matrilocal, meaning the couple lived among the Israelites, which was very rare. So give me the one famous example in the Torah where you have someone who had a non-Jewish father. You mentioned it last time. Okay? The Megadeth, the one who cursed God. What does the Torah say? It says about him in Vayikra 24, Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelit, Vahu ben Ish Mitzri, Betoch ben Yisrael, Vayinotzu b'machane ben HaYisraelit, V'Isha Yisraeli. So the son of the Israelite woman, who was the son of an Egyptian man, went out among the people of Israel, and he was quarreling in the camp between him and an Israelite man. So what does that tell you? That he was part of the community, but he was a distant part of the community. He was not an Israelite man. The other fellow was an Israelite man. He was simply the son of an Israelite woman.
No, in fact, what it's saying is he wasn't a Jew at all.
Forget that. Let's not use the word Jew, because Jew is an anachronistic term. He's not fully part of the community. He's there. He's located there, but in some way he's not accepted. Well, that was his complaint, so they say.
But having a Jewish mother did not give him creds at that point.
Not much. Not much.
Did these people have the status of a Ger Toshav?
Well, Ger Toshav is once they enter into the land of Canaan, which is, this is not the case, which is dealing in the Midbar. So, and I don't think so. I think that Ger Toshav is to be defined as someone without Israelite ancestry. Entirely without Israelite ancestry. Okay. We have other examples. We don't have time to get into all the examples, but suffice it to say that you do have occasions where there's a Jewish mother, a non-Jewish father, and if they're in the land of Israel, they're part of the community, so we'll follow a matrilineal principle, but even then, this individual is not accorded the same status as your average Israelite. Okay. What happened next? Ezra tried to expel the foreign wives and their children. Okay, in the early Second Commonwealth period, they have 113 foreign wives, and there is an episode of repentance, trying to turn back towards the law of Moses, towards the law of the Torah, and atone for the misdeeds of the early Commonwealth period, including this assimilation and intermarriage. Well, some say that Ezra invented the matrilineal principle, which would explain why he ignored mixed marriages between foreign husbands and Jewish women, because at least in those cases, the kids were Jewish. Makes sense? Makes sense. But that might not be the correct interpretation. Why not? Because maybe Ezra ignored those marriages of Jewish women and non-Jewish husbands, just like the earlier biblical writers ignored those unions, because they weren't so common, and because the women were lost causes anyway. And furthermore, listen to this one, maybe Ezra didn't have jurisdiction over those marriages because the man is the dominant figure in the household, and Ezra was given permission by the Persian authorities to be an authoritative political figure in Yehud, Judea, only over Jews. So if it's a Jewish husband and a foreign wife, he has the right, as the exerting temporal authority, to kick out the foreign wife. But if it's a Jewish wife and a non-Jewish husband, that marriage is out of bounds for him. He can't touch them.
What was the general secular identification of Jews, like Roman authorities, Persian authorities? Did they consider matrilineal as well as paternal?
Okay, so when we get to the Roman period, we're going to see how there is a tremendous correlation between Roman law and Jewish law, rabbinic law, concerning matrilineal versus patrilineal. We don't know much about the earlier times other than to assume that things followed the father, because that's how it always was. Okay, so in truth, Ezra was not the one who tried to expel the foreign wives. It was actually Shechaniah ben Yechiel. If you go to the book of Ezra, chapter 10, verse 2 and verse 3, you'll see clearly that he was not the one to initiate the idea. It was like a right-wing extremist who said, let's kick out the Goyisha women and their kids. And then Ezra goes along with it. But it wasn't his original idea. Okay, furthermore, even if you want to say that it was Ezra's idea, this would not be a matrilineal principle. It would be a bilateral requirement that both mother and father be Jewish in order for you to stay within the community. Because think about it, that's what's happening. We're getting rid of the half-Jews because they were the wrong half, but maybe there's no such thing as the wrong or the right half. You have to have both halves. Yeah.
I'm thinking now, whenever we hear about somebody, it says Ben and the father.
Right.
Very rarely, does it say the
mother's
name?
Very rarely, right?
It's meant only by the
time. Right, yeah. Because parenthood was considered only the domain of the father.
And usually we say, you know who the mother is.
Well, we're going to get to that point. That's relevant for tonight. That's relevant for tonight. So, now, another theory about Ezra's action is not that he was determining who had Jewish status and eliminating those who failed to make the grade, but rather he was separating those of mixed or bad yichus from those with good yichus out of an obsession with preserving genealogical purity. So it wasn't religious status that was in play, but genealogical purity. And we find in the Gemara Kiddushin, Yevamos, again and again, this idea of Malach Subi Uchasin. We have elevated standards when it comes to preserving genealogical purity for parts of our people, those who still have maintained the purity over the years, or for Kohanim, etc., etc. It's not an absolute requirement, or sometimes it becomes a matter of halacha, but it's something that's important. All right, well, they're entitled to their opinion.
Can you say that that was also a political concern? If you have a mixed marriage, or
yes,
a quote-unquote pure one,
yes,
who are you going to be a friend?
Yes, okay, so the political concerns were real. We know that Yehud was a fledgling society with enemies to the north, enemies to the south, not so friendly authorities 1,000 miles to the east back home in Persia, okay, and the presence of like a fifth column within the camp could be dangerous. So yes, getting rid of foreigners who are married to your own group, it's a risky proposition either way, but maybe the safer bet is to get rid of them. So there is a political element there too.
How did this affect
It doesn't, because the Shvatim cease to exist. The Second Commonwealth is all about Jews, not about the Aseret Shvatim, or the Yud Bet Shvatim of Yisrael, and the old properties that were owned by, you know, the Shtei Achuzah from biblical times. That's over and done with. It's a new Commonwealth, new rules. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So that's another consideration. That there may have been a dearth of available Jewish women, therefore, out of necessity, there was a marriage to a heathen woman. There is another time in Jewish history where there may be too many women and not enough men, and that's going to play into the rabbinic decision, possibly, to change the rules in the second century of the Common Era. But we'll have to wait another half hour for that. Okay. Now, let's continue. So, the literature of the Second Temple period shows that the matrilineal principle was unknown in that we don't find attempts to, quote-unquote, kosher the biblical examples of intermarriage through homiletic interpretation or claims of conversion. Whereas we do find that in the rabbinic period, which would mean one of two things. Either the principle didn't exist, or even if Ezra initiated it, he wasn't very successful, and people didn't adopt it. So all throughout the apocryphal writings, Book of Jubilees, Testament to the 12 Patriarchs, all the stuff that nobody ever reads, okay, you're not going to find the matrilineal principle expressly stated, or any attempt to manipulate the data of the earlier biblical period to make it conform to what we know the halakha is, as opposed to in the midrashic literature of the rabbis, where you have that left and right. That if so-and-so married a non-Jew, what must that non-Jew have done? Converted to Judaism. Okay, so the absence of that kind of literature in the earlier period indicates probably this principle didn't exist. Okay, for example, in the Book of Jubilees, Tamar is an Aramean. But in rabbinic literature, she's a convert. Paul, Philo, and Josephus don't know either half of the matrilineal principle. Philo considered the child of either type of mixed marriage to be a mamzer. Or not. He didn't use the word mamzer because he's not writing in Hebrew, but he can use the word nothos, which means bastard in Greek. So Paul thinks that either parent is enough to be initiated into the Church of Christ. So interestingly, Philo says you need both parents. Paul says one parent, either one, is good enough. Which I'm going to say something that will get me in trouble. No, I'm not going to turn the tape off because it's not going to get me in trouble with the Orthodox. It's going to get me in trouble with the Reform. The Reform in 1983 adopted not patrilineal descent, but non-lineal descent. That either parent can render the kid Jewish so long as there are rites of initiation and the pretense of a Jewish life. What Paul is saying is exactly the same thing. Not patrilineal or matrilineal, but non-lineal. Either one is sufficient to take your pick. So, in many ways, Reform Judaism is Pauline Judaism. All right. I don't want to get in trouble. Okay. So,
those are the perils of Pauline.
Yep. Now, Josephus records that male conversion of pagans who married Herodian princesses. So, males who married Herodian princesses converted to Judaism by means of circumcision. Circumcision makes them Jewish. But no mention is made of women converting to marry Herodian princesses. And we know many such pagan women did marry Herodian princesses. Why? Why is there no record in...
So what are women
marry princesses? No, Herodian prince, yeah. My head is in the clouds. Okay, so no record is made of a woman converting to marry a Herodian prince. So why not? The answer is that biblically this wouldn't have been necessary because she converts by simply being taken into marriage. And Josephus only knows the biblical style, not the later rabbinic style.
No mikveh.
No, so mikveh only comes into play in the 2nd century, in the Tanitic period. Earlier than that, there's no reference to mikveh as a manner of conversion. Only bris for a man. As for a woman, there's no initiation because she just marries the guy.
So the mikveh is for going to har habayis or something like that.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Tons of mikvahs,
yeah, absolutely, yeah, but not for proselytism. Okay, so therefore, here's the most important example of them all. Herod's mother was of what nationality? Herod's mother was of what nationality? So Herod's father was Antipater, who was an Idumean. Herod's mother was an Arab. Did she convert to Judaism, thereby making Herod into a Jew? No, she didn't have to, because women didn't convert. Women simply got married. And since the father, Antipater, was a converted Idumean, therefore Herod is a Jew by the standards of the time. And Herod can and Josephus can write this, not making any attempt to rob Herod of his Jewish status. There's no attempt here to call Herod a goy. Josephus is simply saying the mother was an Arab, the father was a converted Idumean. That makes Herod a Jew because by the standards of the time, that's what it is. Okay, now. Let's go to rabbinic literature and see where all this changes. The Mishnah Kiddushin 3:12 says the following. Let's go to the Mishnah. We're not going to read the whole thing because it's going to take us forever, but let's just read the key paragraph. Kol mi she'ein la alav kiddushin, aval yesh la alacherim kiddushin, havlad mamzer, ve'ezezeh habal achat mikol rayot sheba Torah. So if you have a situation where a woman could get married, but could not get married to the man with whom she had relations, then the child will be a mamzer. What is such an example? A Jewish woman having relations with an incestuous relative. Okay? So there could, both parties could get married, just not to each other. And even if they tried to, not only would it be sinful, it would be invalid. Mamzer. Then, or Eish Yashish, because she's already married and she can't marry to two husbands. Okay, but then, Kol mi she'ein la lo alav lo alachirim kedushin, a woman who can't get married to her paramour and couldn't get married to anybody else, meaning could not get Jewishly married, no kedushin, havlad kamota. The child is like her in status. Ve'ezezeh, and what are the examples? Shifcha v'nochrit, a Canaanite servant girl, and a Gentile woman. A Canaanite servant girl and a Gentile woman are not able to contract kiddushin with anyone. So therefore, their children are going to be like them, either slave or Gentile. So here we see very clearly what? Then the not so much the full matrilineal principle, but the non-patrilineal aspect of things. That a Jewish father is insufficient to render the kid Jewish. Because if the mother is a pagan or is a Canaanite slave girl, that ruins it for the kid. It's going to follow the... Huh? So we might learn something from Eved Ivri, but we'll have to hold off for a few minutes. There will be an important pasuk in regard to Eved Ivri. So you don't need kiddushin to make somebody a legitimate child. You don't need kiddushin, but you need the possibility of kiddushin on the part of the woman to make the kid Jewish. That's what you need. Out of wedlock child is not necessarily an illegitimate child. But you need the possibility of kiddushin to make the kid Jewish. Now let's go to the next Mishnah, which is Yevamos 2:5, where you have implied this rule. It's implied but not stated explicitly. Mi sheyesh lo ach mikol makom zokek et eshet achiv liyibum. If you have a brother anywhere in the world, from any source, that will bind your widow upon your death in the yibum relationship, assuming you had no kids. Chutz mimi sheyesh lo min shivcha min hanochrit. Okay, except if there was a brother from a mother who was a Canaanite slave girl or a Gentile woman. Meaning you two men have the same Jewish father, but you had different mothers. One of you had a good Jewish mother, and the other one had a non-Jewish mother. So the one who had the non-Jewish mother, but the same father, that's not considered having a brother. Therefore, upon the death of the Jewish fellow, his wife is not bound in Yibum to the other fellow because it's not her brother-in-law. This man is out of the picture. He isn't Jewish. Now, it doesn't say he's not Jewish. It says he's out of the picture for Yibum purposes. We are to infer the reason why he's out of the picture for Yibum purposes is because he isn't Jewish. And why isn't he Jewish? Because patrilineal descent is insufficient to make you Jewish. Okay. Now let's go to the other half of the matrilineal principle. This is a Mishnah Yevamos 7:5. Bat Yisrael le Kohen, ubat Kohen le Yisrael. You have two Jews marry each other. V'yalda hemen ubat, and they have a daughter. V'halcha habat v'niset le'evero le'goy. And the girl, who's a Jewish girl, marries a slave or a non-Jew. V'yalda hemen uben, and she has a child. Harezem mamzer. The kid is a mamzer. So, Jewish mother, pagan father, child is a mamzer. Is a mamzer Jewish?
Yeah.
Yes! Okay. So now we finally have the matrilineal principle fully articulated. So in the earlier Mishnayos we had Jewish father is insufficient. Now we have Jewish mother makes you Jewish. But, what? Mamzer. Is that the halacha?
No,
if it were the halacha, we'd be in big trouble. I'd have a lot of problems on my hand. All right, so let's now go to the Tosefta that tells us what we really do hold like. So Tosefta says like this: Goy ve'eved habo al bas Yisrael, a non-Jew or a male slave who have relations with a Jewish woman, ve'olida ben, and they have a child, havlad mamzer. The child is a mamzer, but Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Shimon, Ein mamzer lemina isha shiyisur yisur eva v'chem lekaris. You're not going to have a mamzer status conferred upon anyone unless they were born of a forbidden sexual union that is punishable by extirpation, by spiritual excision, chiv karis, or misa bidei adam, death at the hands of the earthly court. So very high-level prohibitions will result in mamzer status, but a Jewish woman fornicating with a Gentile man is not a very high-level prohibition. I mean, we shouldn't go around spreading that, but it's prohibited. But it's not a high-level prohibition that leads to a very severe sanction. Therefore, if there's a pregnancy and a child born out of that, the kid is not a mamzer. That, in fact, is the halacha. Okay, so now we see the principles of our law expressed in the Mishnah and in the Tosefta. Okay. The question then is, can we date these texts? When were these texts written? And when did these laws emerge? So the truth is, it's not an easy matter to date them at all. But it's probably from the Yavne period, which means from the year 70 to the year 135. And the reason why we say that is because Rabbi Yishmael appears in several of these related passages, and Rabbi Yishmael was one of the two leading figures of the third Tannaitic generation, together with Rabbi Akiva, in the 1-teens, 1-20s, and early 1-30s. So let's assume that right around the year 100, these rules are emerging. Okay, but there was no absolute consensus, even within the rabbinic camp. And I'm going to read to you some stories that you never heard before, and are going to shock you. Two stories in particular. So one of them is from Avos de Rabbi Nassan, and another is from the Yerushalmi. First, Avos de Rabbi Nassan. Rabbi Tzadok haya gadol hador. Rabbi Tzadok was the great man of his generation. Keshenishba l'Romi, when he was captured and taken to Rome after the destruction in 70, Natalatu Matronisa Achat, a certain Roman noblewoman imprisoned him, Vishagwalo Shivcha Achat Yafa, and put in his jail cell a very attractive slave girl. Kevan Shira Ota, when Rabbi Tzadok saw her, Natanenav Bakotel, Shalo Yirena, by Yoshev Shoneko Halila, like a good rabbi, he turned his glance away from her and learned all night long. Okay? He was reviewing his Mishnayos. Leshacharis, in the morning, Halchav Hikbila Etzel Gavirta. So the slave girl went back to her matron. Amra la shaveli hamavet mishnatati li shazeh. The slave girl says, "I'd rather die than be with this man." Meaning, the girl wasn't thinking she was going to be raped. She was figuring this is a sexual opportunity, and she was hoping for something to happen, and nothing happened. And so she says, "I'd rather be dead than be with this guy." So shalcha v'karolo, the matron calls for Rabbi Tzadok, v'amrolo, and says to him, "Ipnei malo asita imishazot kederach shiasu b'nei adam." It's a great expression. Why didn't you do with this woman what people normally do? So amarla ma'ese. He said, "What could I do? Mikahuna gedola ani. I'm from the priestly family. Mishpara gedola ani, from a great family. Amarti. I said to myself, Shema avo aleha. Maybe I'll have relations with her. Viherbeiti mamzerim biYisrael, and I would produce increased number of mamzerim in the Jewish world." Now wait a second. It's a heathen woman and a Jewish man. By the matrilineal principle, the child, if there would be one from this, would be a goy. And yet he's saying, "I don't want to manufacture mamzerim." Now, you could argue he was just saying it like a throwaway line to give an excuse for why he didn't have relations with her. However, if we want to take him at face value, what does that mean, Rabbi Tzadok held? That we can follow patrilineal descent, but from a mixed union, it would result in it producing a mamzer. Not a full-fledged Jew, but a Jew who has a stigma.
But it is a kohen. Maybe he's considering that.
Nah, forget the kohen.
Even though
yeah.
Maybe she was a Jewish slave.
No, it's a shifcha. It means she was a non-Jewish slave.
So it could be a Roman anyway.
Okay, so the point is, if we take it at face value, Rabbi Tzadok holds the child of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish woman is a mamzer, which means a Jew, not a goy. Okay. If that were the only source that is at odds with the conventional halacha, I would ignore it and say, yeah, maybe he wasn't being serious. But we have another story, which is much juicier. Okay. This is a Gemara in Yerushalmi.
This one he does, it's
fine. No. So, Yaakov Ish Kfar Giboraya. Yaakov of the town of Niboraya. Aza Letzur. He went to Tyre in Lebanon. Atu she'elin le mahu migzor barad armiyasa b'shabata. What's the rule about circumcising the child of a Jewish father and a Gentile mother on Shabbos? Now, bear in mind that circumcision overrides the Shabbos when it is a mitzvah. When it's not a mitzvah, it's a malacha, and you can't do it. So, if you're asking,
I deferred bris, cannot be moved to another Shabbos.
Correct. So, only eighth day bris for someone obligated in an eighth day bris can have it done on Shabbos. So, if you're asking, can you do this bris on Shabbos? It seems like what you're really asking is the kid Jewish? Okay. So, Savar Lemishri. So, this Yaakov of Narboya, he said, it's allowed. Min hada v'yisyaldu amishpachotam levet avotam. And the basis for his decision was that the verse in Torah says, that we counted people based upon the father's house. So basically, he's cherry-picking a verse in the Bible that says we go after the father. But then again, the whole Bible says that. He didn't have to deduce things from that one verse. He could have picked from a lot of different verses. Lebeit Avotam, but it's again and again in the Torah. So, Shama Rabbi Chagai. Rabbi Chagai heard about this. Amar Yete V'Yilki. Let Yaakov come here and I'll give him corporal punishment. I'll smack him around for issuing such a horrific ruling. Amar Le Mehechan Atam Alkeni. So Yaakov says to Rabbi Chagai, on what basis are you going to give me corporal punishment? Amar Le Min Hadain, from the following. The verse says in Ezra, V'atanich Rod Brit, Lotzi Kohanashim Anochriot, Banolad Mehen. Let us make a covenant now and expel the foreign wives and the children born from the foreign wives. So what do we see? That the matrilineal principle, only a Jewish mother makes you Jewish, and that's why in Ezra they wanted to kick out the Goyish women and their children. So Amar Lei, Yaakov says back to Rabbi Chagai, Umin HaKabola Atam Alkeni, you're going to give me corporal punishment saying that I'm wrong, citing a verse from the Kabbalah? By the way, what's the Kabbalah? No. Huh? No. We learned about this maybe 6-7 weeks ago. Maybe just around Pesach time. What's the Kabbalah? The Kabbalah is the Bible, but not the Torah. So the Nevi'im and Ketuvim. So you're trying to prove that I'm wrong about a key issue in Judaism, where I've cited the Torah, and you're citing the book of Ezra? Come on, give me a break. The book of Ezra? So, Amar Le Uche Torah. If you want, Rabbi Chagai says, I'll cite the Torah to prove you're wrong. Umin Hadain Oraita. And what? And where is that verse in Torah? As Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rishim Bar Yochai, Lo Titchatein Bam. Don't marry them. Now wait a second. The don't marry them verse, that was referring to the Canaanim. And it doesn't say anything about the status of children. It just says don't marry them. But whatever it is, he accepted it. Amalei chavot chavotcha. So Yaakov says to Rabbi Chagai, okay, smack me. Dehitava beklata. It's good for me to receive the whipping. What happened here? Rabbi Chagai quoted an authoritative interpretation of the Deuteronomy chapter 7 of Lo Titchatein Bam, which Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said means that the child of a non-Jewish woman is not a Jew. And so since that's the rule, and Yaakov is now saying, well, I didn't know that, I was reading a different verse, I had a different opinion, but now I accept your ruling. So I was wrong about a very key issue in Jewish life. It's good for me to get a whipping, meaning I deserved it. Okay. In a few minutes, we'll have to get back to how important that one passage is and what it teaches us. But for the moment, all we can see is that there is in the Talmud an opinion that patrilineal descent was a real possibility, and that matrilineal descent might have been legitimate, but produces mamzerim, or that patrilineal produces mamzerim. So you have a lot of different possibilities here that are other than what we know the halacha to be today. Okay. So now let's ask a simple question. Why did the rabbis of the Mishnah change the system? Why did they change it? So there are 6 possible answers. And we have 15 minutes, but we're going to go long tonight. One last hurrah. So one answer is they resorted to Scripture. They found something compelling in the Torah that led them to believe that the child of a Jewish woman is a Jew and the child of a Jewish father is a Goy. So one explanation is that they learned it from Deuteronomy 7:3. Because let's go back to that Pasuk. Don't marry them, don't marry their sons, and don't marry their daughters. And then, Ki yasiret bincha me'acharai, he will steer your son away from me, from God, God is saying, and they will serve other gods. So, the way it's interpreted is that your son can only be led astray if he's your son. And in a mixed marriage, if the father is the pagan leading your son astray, It means the mother was Jewish and it's your son, which means matrilineal Judaism. But it doesn't say that she will lead you astray, she being the pagan. And if that were the case, it would have meant that the father was a Jew and the kid was a Jew. It doesn't say that. Therefore what? When the father is a Jew, the kid isn't a Jew. So, is that a compelling interpretation of the verse?
No.
Not especially, because what the verse really means, what it really means, is not that your son, meaning the child of the mixed marriage, will be led astray. No. The meaning of the verse is the partner in the mixed marriage will be led astray.
Not God's son. I don't mean
No. No. The one who marries a non-Jew will be led into another faith. And how do I know that's the case? It says bincha. Bincha seems to indicate the child of this union. No, that's not what it means. Why? Go back to the preceding verse. It says bitcha lo titen livno ubito lo tikach livnecha. The Torah is speaking to the person, not who's in their early 20s and on the verge of getting married and about to have children. The Torah is speaking to the parent who's in their 50s and has a child of marriageable age and says, don't marry them off to a goy or a goyis. Okay? And because what's going to happen if they do? The person in the marriage will go and become a pagan, not their eventual progeny. Therefore, this verse, is it compelling to prove the matrilineal principle? Far from it. Okay, that's one source. Let's go to another source, which is in the Mechilta. And it's based upon a pasuk in Devarim. So the pasuk is, Ki hiyele ish shtei nashim, if a man will have two wives. Okay, so, Ahachat ahuvah v'ahachat tznuah v'yaldu lo vanim, and he shall have children. So this is the Sifri, not the Mechilta. The Mechilta will be doing next. It says, Ki tiyena l'ishtein Hashim. So, what's the rule? Mi sheholadot shelo, yatsu elu shein holadot shelo. If you can have matrimony with these women, then the kid is considered your kid. But if you couldn't have matrimony with that woman, because she was a pagan, then what? It's not your kid. Which means what? It doesn't prove the matrilineal principle, but it proves that patrilineality is insufficient. That the Jewish father alone isn't good enough.
Just talking about after you married the one ship that had him.
So by smuchim, by juxtaposition, that's the way Chazal interpreted. But the plain reading is that just you had two wives, and you liked one and you didn't like the other. Okay, so what's the third source? So who mentioned the Eved Ivri? The Eved Ivri, okay, so now let's go to the Eved Ivri. It says about the Eved Ivri that Haisha Viladeha Tiyela Adoneha V'hu Yetzei Begapo, that the Hebrew slave is being given a heathen slave girl to procreate with, and okay, let's assume that's a side point, but yes, okay. So he's given a heathen slave girl to procreate with, and they have children. And upon his manumission, the slave girl and the children remain slaves. So what does the Mechilta say? Magid shivladeha kamoha, that the offspring are like her. So, all right, fine, the offspring are like her. She was a slave girl, they are slaves. Ainli ela shivcha shivladeha kamoha. I only know that in the case of a slave girl, they're like her. Nachris minayin. How do I know to extend this rule to all Gentile women, not just to a slave girl? So Rabbi Yishmael Omer, ma shivcha kanane shein la kiddushin, mikol adam uvladeha kamoha. Just as the slave girl cannot contract kiddushin with anyone, so the offspring are like her. So to anyone who cannot contract kiddushin with anyone else, the offspring are like her. Namely, all pagan women. Now, that's an extension. Is that the plain reading of the text? No, it has nothing to do with the text. It's a dramatic extension. And a further extension is that it applies not only to a Hebrew slave, but to all Jews, to all Jewish men. So two very drastic extensions of the underlying legal premise of the Pasuk produce the matrilineal principle in its totality. Did you have to read it that way? No. So in the end, what do we have? Is Scripture alone a compelling reason to change the rules? from patrilineal to matrilineal? Not really. Some of those psukim are good hooks after the fact, like as an asmachta. Okay, it's not a it's not something that you would say, oh, I proved my point, but rather accepting my point a priori, then I can look to those pasuk, to that pasuk, and say, yeah, it's consistent with what I have to say. Okay, so if we're not going to the Bible, what other reasons do we have? Well, we have a few more. Next possibility is that it was Ezra, but Rabbi Chagi may have argued with Yaakov of Kfar Naboya that Ezra established the matrilineal rule, but Yaakov responded, well, how can you prove your point from Divrei Kabbalah, from a part of the Bible that's not the Torah? So there's a real hesitation on the part of anyone in the rabbinic literature to prove a serious Judaic point from a part of the Tanakh that isn't the Torah. I mean, after all, it's the law of Moses. It's not the law of Joshua and Ezekiel and Isaiah. We have a rabbinic dictum of Ein Navi Rashai L'Chadesh Davar. A prophet is not allowed to invent new rules. The whole point is that the Torah is the Torah of Moses. So something as serious as Jewish status laws should not be left to Ezra. So you understand the hesitation, even though Rabbi Chagai resorted to it, where Yaakov said you shouldn't resort to that.
But Ezra's dealing with
a
situation.
He sees how it's going. Okay, so... Shas Hadchak, all right, fine. Okay, but assuming that we're not going to allow the Shas Hadchak and extenuating circumstances to dictate biblical law, assuming that for the moment, then you wouldn't want to say Ezra changed the rules. Okay, so now let's go to the third possibility. And that is, someone mentioned it before, you always know who the mother is, you don't know who the father is. The inherent uncertainty of paternity in the pre-genetic testing era. Okay, the problem with this answer, and it's a very weak answer, is because in nearly all matters of halacha, we follow the patrilineal line. Okay, except for mixed marriages. In all other respects, we follow the father. For kahuna, for leviyah, for all things, we follow the father. But not for mixed marriages. So don't tell me it was because of uncertain paternity. Next possibility. The intimacy of motherhood. Meaning there's such a strong connection between a mother and child. And therefore, that should determine religious status. How do you like that?
That's weaker than the first one.
Okay.
The women
so the truth of the matter is that in the ancient world, the mother was not considered a parent. The father is the parent of the child, and the female just nurtures the seed. That was the bad old days of the classical world. That was the thinking across the board in most cultures.
And yet okay. You would have gods like Astarte, and it's always a woman who is the goddess of fertility.
Oh, okay, because the woman has to give birth. But the point is that the father is the parent. So to say that religious status is going to be conferred by the mother because of the intimacy of motherhood is a very weak answer. There is only one area of Judaism, so extra bonus points for those who get this right, where the rabbinic literature does recognize and claims that the Bible recognizes how the mother is the closer parent. There we go. Correct. So, kaber et avicha ve'et imecha. Okay, ishimo ve'aviv tirau. Correct. So there's an assumption that a person will respect their mother more, and thus the Bible has to go out of its way to instruct you to respect your father, placing the father before the mother. Excellent. So that's the one area.
Why would they not prove the opposite? Because the father's name is listed first.
Because whatever is counterintuitive, the Bible must tell us. Whatever is intuitive, the Bible need not tell us.
What's that, the 11th
commandment? All right. So, now let's go to another answer. And that is the similarity between Roman law and rabbinic law. The halakha and Roman law are the same in the following respects. We follow a matrilineal principle for two citizens marrying each other, but the child will have the status of the father, or for two non-citizens marrying each other, but we'll follow a matrilineal approach for mixed unions. Okay? Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but we don't have time to go into all the details. But basically, for two citizens or two non-citizens, what matters is the father. For a mix between citizen and non-citizen, will follow the mother. And just as Judaism would frown upon this mixed marriage between the Jew and the Goy, so too Roman law would frown upon the marriage between a citizen and a non-citizen. Okay? Rabbinic law has the idea of kiddushin, something that we don't see in the Torah. In Roman law, there's a concept of connubium, which is basically the same thing, the idea that you have the ability to contract a marriage. So, I understand that there's this similarity, and these similarities were noticed by the early 20th century Jewish scholars like Louis Epstein, Boaz Cohen, who were students both of Halacha and of the Roman codes. But why would how would the rabbis know the Roman law, number one, if they weren't students of it? And number two, why would they be in the habit of copying the Romans? The Romans were the enemy. We hated the Romans. So why would we adopt their rules when it comes to our halacha of status? So although it's a compelling answer in terms of the data, the logic behind it seems a little bit missing. Okay. Now the last approach to this is to say that mixed marriages are like forbidden mixtures. Let me read you a Mishnah, and then you'll tell me what I'm trying to get across here. This is a Mishnah in Kilayim. Kilayim chapter 8, Mishnah 4. It sounds like this. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kolhan noladim min hasus, afal pi sha'avihen chamor, mutarin ze al ze. So anyone born from a horse, even though the father was a donkey, they're permitted with one another. And the reciprocal too. If they're born of a donkey, but their father was a horse, they're permitted one another. So, if you mix a donkey and a horse, what happens?
Mule.
You have a mule. Well, what is a mule? Is it a donkey or a horse? So, you would need to know what it is in order to avoid the problem of crossbreeding. But wait a second, a mule is sterile, so you have no problem with crossbreeding it. But you do have a problem of lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav. Don't plow with an ox and a donkey together. So two species of animal of different physical capacity and size should not be put under the same yoke. Tzar balei chaim. One would drag the other. So we need to know, any given mule, is it a horse or is it a donkey? And what is this Mishnah saying? You follow the mother. Matrilineal descent among mules. Oive. So where is this headed? That just as you have matrilineal descent amongst mixed unions in the animal kingdom, you're going to have matrilineal descent amongst mixed unions in the people kingdom too. All right. Why should this be the case? Well, not that I'm trying to approve of what sounds like xenophobia and bigotry in the rabbinic writings, but the non-Jewish world was regarded as Am Hadome Lachamor, the nations that are similar to the donkey. Where is that based on? In the Akedah episode, Shvulacham Po'im HaChamor. You, the servant boy, stay here with the donkey while me and Isaac go up to the top of the mountain. So you have this undesirable relationship between the Jew and the heathen. We'll compare it to what we know in the laws of Kilayim, and we'll apply those laws here. Matrilineal descent and mixed unions. Okay. But with all these answers given, why did the rabbis change the rules? So some say that there were mass rapes of Jewish women by Roman soldiers during the great wars of 66 to 70 and 132 to 135, and the sages had rachmanis on the children. But is that a compelling theory? So the answer is not really. Because, number one, the Mishnah said the kids are mamzerim. What's worse? To have a child who's a mamzer, which is irredeemable, so to speak, or to have a child who's a goy, who at least can be converted to Judaism. In many ways, a mamzer status is worse. So you weren't doing any chesed to the girl who was raped, or to the kid, but declaring the offspring a mamzer. Okay.
Because if you call a mamzer, you can't call them a goy, then you convert.
No. But Mamzer is a Jew. There's no changing that. Goy, at least he could change. So my point is, if you wanted to be charitable towards them, you wouldn't have made that the law. Okay, now the other problem with this theory is that only explains one half of the principle of child of a Jewish mother, Gentile father is a Jew, whether stigmatized or not. It doesn't explain why declare the child of a Jewish father and a Gentile mother to be a goy when by the biblical rules of the game, the kid was Jewish. Why do that to them? What does that have to do with women being raped in war? It seems to be totally unrelated. So, and if the purpose was to restrain intermarriage, which was low anyway, it wasn't a common thing in those days, then they should have made a bilateral requirement of Jewish and Jewish father and mother, not made it one out of the two, a specific one out of the two. So, therefore, let's posit an answer to the 2 minutes we have left. In the post-Hasmonean era, there was the possibility of conversion for men via circumcision. Okay, it was now possible for the private individual, forget the Idumeans and the Iturians who were converted in mass, you know, large numbers. We're talking about private individual who likes Judaism, wants to make the jump from God-fearer to outright proselyte, outright Jew. So post-Hasmonean period, you could do this. Cut off the foreskin, voila, you're a Jew. In the second century of the Common Era, there is finally conversion for women via the mikveh. Now there's a ceremony for them too. So, now it makes sense that the child of a Jewish father and a Gentile mother should be regarded as a Gentile if the mother has not exercised the option of converting. Why? Because if the whole concern is compromising the Judaic standing of the family, well, someone with a foreign ancestry of foreign religious beliefs, that's a bad thing, especially if it's a mother, okay? Close relationship with the child. So if the mother could convert and does so, she's proven her worth. And the kid will be a good Jew, hopefully. But if the mother had the option of converting and didn't, what does that say about her? She's not interested in Judaism and may even be interested in subverting the religiosity of her husband. Therefore what? These kids aren't Jewish. As a matter of status, and as a matter of the real world. They're not going to be given a Jewish upbringing. Therefore, the law reflected what was probably going to happen anyway. These kids would not be raised as good Jews. Therefore, they're not Jewish. And as for the Jewish mother, non-Jewish father, so let's assume that the Rachmanis on them because of the rape issue. So, if you combine the issue of wartime sexual misdeeds by Roman officers, and the issue of the new concept of female conversion, you put them all together, and you have both halves of the matrilineal principle emerging in the second century. Okay, so that's enough with the ancient period. Why is a lot of this distressing to some traditional thinkers? Why might a traditional Jew be distressed by this, by what I just presented to you?
Things change.
Correct. Correct. So it's a fundamental issue. Who is a Jew? And it's very tempting to say that the rules of status are what they are because they always were that way. And it's a fallback argumentative position for those trying to sustain the status quo and not interested in changing it given modern problems. So that's what the polemicists in the traditional world have been saying to counter the actions of the reformists for the past 33 years. Truth of the matter is even more than 33 years, because although it was 1983 that the CCAR voted on patrilineal descent, actually, I wrote a paper on this in graduate school, it was dating back to 1909 that they were first considering it. In the days of Kaufman Kohler, and then in 1926 they made another step in that direction, and then in 1947 another step in that direction. It was a slow progression towards eventually accepting patrilineal descent, but all along the way you had everyone to the right of the reform movement saying you can't do this, it's from time immemorial, these are the rules. But is it really from time immemorial? Or can we pinpoint a specific time on the chronological spectrum when this started? So it looks like it's more recent than the polemicists argued. But that doesn't mean that changes are legitimate. It just means that the situation we've had now has been around for 1,900 years, 2,000 years, not 5,000 years. Okay. Now, another reason why it could be troubling is because you could argue that, forget that laws change, that the logic isn't all that compelling, and therefore maybe the law should be other than what it is. Is the logic of matrilineal descent compelling nowadays?
Not really.
Any more so than patrilineal?
No. I don't see it. I mean, I know people who are reformed, and uh-huh. they were ostracized, I mean, in Orthodox rules,
yeah,
because
yeah.
the wife wasn't married.
Yeah.
But here they had a place that would be able to accept both husband and wife, even though the
yeah.
wife is not legislatively Jewish.
Right. Yeah. So that's the real problem. Not so much that the law has evolved, but that the logic is not something that you can convincingly impress upon someone who isn't already on board.
Especially after Hitler.
You're right. So, but then, but the counter argument is, who made Hitler the chief rabbi?
Hitler.
No, if we believe this yeah. from HaKadosh Baruch Hu,
yeah.
And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling you that a Jew, when he intermarries,
yeah, yeah.
no matter how far you want to go, you're still going to be Jewish.
Yeah.
That's our rules.
Well, so the Zera Yisrael is something that the enemies of our people will hold against us, even if it's a minute fraction. That I think everyone would concede.
Yeah, but we believe it's all maneuvered by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So
yeah. Now, my last point for tonight is that Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, one of the great scholars of early and mid-20th century Jewish life, so he said, when asked, why is matrilineal descent the deciding point in Jewish status, he admitted, it's difficult for us to explain. Difficult for us to explain. He didn't want to posit his own Weinbergian answer that he said was the definite answer. He says it's difficult for us to explain. Therefore, it's an uncomfortable topic because we can't fight our ideological opponents with strong ammunition other than to say you have many, many centuries in our favor. That's really what it boils down to.
Well, with the Russian Jews in Israel,
more firm in that respect.
Yeah,
more connected to God.
Huh?
Are the women more connected to God?
Absolutely, in my shul for sure.
Right.
Well, so, Alan, what was your point?
No, the Russian Jews, you know, they need to be mekel to bring them in. I mean,
okay,
the
so that's a political and national issue,
right.
And the question is, should religious considerations play into political and national issues? And Ben-Gurion, in 1958, thought it wise to at least solicit the advice of the great theologians of the 20th century when deciding on the minutiae and the details of the law of return. And he sent out letters to 100 great religious figures, including Saul Lieberman, Heschel, Rav Soloveitchik, across the spectrum. Many Orthodox figures, but also people beyond the Orthodox camp. And almost everyone responded with traditional arguments in favor of religious status, but not necessarily traditional arguments in terms of national policy on immigration, which in the end led to a split decision. You come in, but you're not really Jewish, which has its own problems. But this will conclude. Saul Lieberman warned Ben-Gurion. He said, don't make a mockery out of proselytism, meaning we have our rules. Don't call somebody Jewish if they're not really Jewish. And make sure that the giur is a legitimate giur. And here, this is not some far extremist Haredi. This is Saul Lieberman talking. But he said, don't make a mockery out of proselytism. And his words were prescient. He knew what he was talking about. On that note, I want to thank everybody for a great year. I'll see you when we come back after the holidays.